This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we have a very special guest. Her name is Hank Phillippe Ryan and her new book is called The Wrong Girl. Hello, and it's out from Forge, I should say.
It's out from Forge, yes, I know. And I love the cover that it says, Hank Phillippe Ryan, The Wrong Girl.
Right. Why do you have three names?
Oh, why do I have three names? Hank, do you really want to know this?
Well, yeah.
Hank is a nickname for Harriet Ann that I acquired in college when someone's, you know, when you're growing up and it's the 50s and you're Harriet. You know, all the cool girls are Debbie and Linda, and you just don't want to be Harriet. So in college, someone gave me the nickname Hank. They said, you don't look like a Harriet, we'll call you Hank. And I wondered at that logic. But
really?
And then Phillippe is an ex-husband's name, but I was using it when I worked at Rolling Stone magazine, and it was my byline.
You worked at Rolling Stone? You lucky person, you.
Oh, I did. It was in the 70s. It was during Watergate. I worked with Hunter Thompson and Richard Avedon, and
really?
It was quite fascinating. And really, you know, here I was, 25, or however it was, old I was, 23, and really getting an inside look at how politics worked and how publishing worked, and to get to know Hunter and Richard Avedon was, you know, it's like going on tour with rock stars. You know, they're both so incredibly talented. They were both so incredibly talented and incredibly wonderful people, and I learned a tremendous amount about lots of things from both of them.
I can imagine. I mean, working, and you must have interviewed. Did you interview celebrities too for the magazine?
I did. I had the funniest little radio show called Rolling Stone Radio News, for which I interviewed the people who were on the cover of the magazine. So everyone from Muhammad Ali to Dustin Hoffman and Robert Moog, who invented the synthesizer. You know, just who, you know, Sybil Shepherd. It was pretty interesting. You know, I learned to do my homework. I learned to do an interview. I learned to tell a story. You know, there are all those things that you do when you're young and having a fantastic opportunity that were really life-changing for me.
One of the things I like about The Wrong Girl and is the relationship between Jake and Jane. I just, you know, it builds so much in the book, and you know, you feel that sexual tension developing. And I like the way you did. I'm just like, oh, good heavens, get these two together. You know, they deserve it. All we can think of is they should be married. What is it with these two?
That's nice. I mean, it's interesting because Jane is a newspaper reporter in Boston. She's been fired from her job in television because she refused to reveal a source. She's an incredibly honorable person. She's devoted and determined and a good journalist. She's 33.
Just like you.
Just like me. I'm 33. I was at one point. I'm the author. I can make her however old I want. Jake is a newly minted police detective in Boston. He's 35. His grandfather, he has something to prove too. His grandfather was the police commissioner, and a lot of his colleagues think Jake was got his gold badge so young because of the legacy of his grandfather, that he doesn't really have the right stuff to be a detective. So
I picture him as like that guy on True Blood, Alcide. Do you ever watch True Blood?
No.
There's a guy named Alcide on True Blood. He's this hunk of a guy. I mean, really hunky guy. That's what I picture Jake looking like, although he's probably a lot bigger than Jake really is in the book.
I love having this conversation because, and it's one of the things that's so funny about the thought of having movies made of the books, is that I don't see him looking like that at all. I sort of envision Jake like looking like Atticus Finch, like Gregory Peck.
Really?
Yeah, and so the idea that you have a completely different vision, and you know, we've both read the same words about him. We've both read the same description of what he looks like, and yet, because of how he behaves, he appears as a different person to each of us. And I really love that. It's one of the things that I think is the magic of writing and reading, is that the author paints a picture of what they think their world is, and yet, you know, when it channels through the book and into the brain of the reader can create the picture they see and the one they're comfortable with and the one they love, and everyone is different. And that's amazing. You know, that's
now, do you
wonderful.
Have a Jake in your life? No.
You know, and it's interesting because people say, are you Jane? You know, you're a reporter. Are you Jane? Do you have a Jake in your life? Do you have a source? Do you have a police detective who tells you stuff or who you're madly in love with? And, you know, it's fiction. It's completely fiction. And that's, again, the magic I keep saying. But I've been a television reporter for almost 40 years now.
Wow.
You know, I have 30 Emmys for investigative reporting. And I'm still on the air at the NBC affiliate in Boston. That's my real job.
Really?
That's my real job, yeah. And so I still work all the time on television. And so I've had people confess to murder. I've wired myself with hidden cameras and confronted corrupt politicians and chased down criminals and gone undercover and in disguise. So
that's dangerous stuff.
Can be. You know, can be. Of course, as a TV reporter, you always have a camera with you, and so I tell my photographer, if it looks like somebody's going to haul off and hit me, just make sure you're rolling. You know, just make sure you get it on camera, because there's going to be evidence of that. So, you know, these people are fiction created out of years of experience. You know, we all think that we're doing our jobs for... You know, I thought I was being a reporter for the sake of being a reporter, for, you know, for getting the goods and getting the stories and breaking news and getting exclusive investigations and changing lives. And really, I was doing that, but I was also doing research. You know, I was doing research. So people say to me, you know, do you do a lot of research for your books? And I say, sweetheart, I've been doing research for 40 years because I just didn't know it. You know, I just didn't know it. So, you know, I know how you get to the back offices in the district attorney's office, and I know how you get into a prison, and, you know, I know what it feels like in a police car in the front and in the back, and what it looks like at a crime scene and what happens with firefighters, you know, because that's what I've been doing for 40 years.
Right.
And so I get to use that reality and create a page-turning, suspenseful, fictional thriller, the Other Woman, the first of the Jane Ryland books, and which won the Mary Higgins Clark Award and was nominated for the Agatha Anthony Daphne Seamus and McCavity, The Other Woman, which is just out in paperback.
Well, you're one of these writers I've seen a lot about online, and people talk about you online a lot, how much they enjoy your book. No, they always say nice things about you, and I this is the first book of yours I've read. I don't know, and you can yell at me, and why haven't you read one before? And
no, I love it. There's still time. You know, your listeners, too, if they're saying, she sounds nice, you know.
It's like going to a book signing. I hate to tell the author I haven't read their books. I mean, it's like the most embarrassing thing to say, no, I haven't read your book. And so I try to make sure when I go to a signing, I've read at least one of the author's books. But
well, the most embarrassing thing to hear is, should I know you? It's like, well, I don't know, should you? That's one of the funny things that authors hear. I'm on Mad Book Tour right now. You can't believe every day I'm in a different state at a different bookstore or library or event. And it's,
do you enjoy that?
I do. I mean, it's kind of interesting. And let me tell you that as a reporter for the past, however, you know, four decades, one of the things that I have learned and one of the things that's sort of in my brain, and I know this sounds silly, is what time it is and what day it is. I mean, I know those. I mean, I can tell you when it's 5 minutes till 11, when, you know, when the news is on at 11 and 6. I know when it's 5. My instinct will say, I should be on. You know, it's 5 till 6. It's 5 till 11. I know exactly what time it is. I know how long 30 seconds is from now. I can time that. I know when someone gives a 10-second soundbite. I know when that's over. And certainly I know what day it is. You know, I have days that I edit and days that I write and days that I report and that kind of thing. So, but as an author and as a writer and on book tour with airplanes and events and time zones and a never-ending schedule, some days I honestly don't know where I am. I can tell you that. And I certainly don't know what time it is. Do you watch Downton Abbey?
Oh, yeah, of course.
And remember the Dowager Duchess says, what's a weekend? And that's sort of how I feel. I there are no weekends. It's all just one day in Phoenix and the next day in Denver and the next day in Albany and the next day in New Jersey. It's great. I mean, I can't begin to tell you what a dream come true it is.
Now, this book is all about, there's a lot about foster care in this book, and it's almost a heartbreaking book to read because of and I'm sure that the stuff you've written in this is real.
Yes, the stuff, yes, absolutely so. What's in that book? What's in the book is real, about the number of children who are waiting for foster care, the number of caseworkers that cannot handle the workload, the number of families who need to be vetted, who would love to take in children, but there aren't enough caseworkers to do that administrative work to make sure that the homes are okay. So the question is, you know, children are waiting, infants are waiting, families are waiting. They need to be matched up. They could be matched up, but there aren't enough people and there isn't enough time. And as a result, the children wait for families. And, you know, the thing that is heartbreaking, too, about it is, as I talk about in the book, you know, it's not the children's fault. They did nothing. They were born into a situation out of a mistake or out of a disappointment or out of a catastrophe or out of abuse or out of a drug situation. Or it's not that, you know, it's nothing that they chose. And because of the flutter of a butterfly wing, you know, they could be a salt and stall or they could be in foster care. And so the system steps in to try to help them, and it just doesn't always work. It just doesn't always work. And and I talk about that a little bit in the book. I mean, I think a good thriller, a good mystery, is about more than just who done it, and even more about why done it. But you know, it has to take you into a world that you might not know about and illuminate something for you, and you know, without beating you over the head about it in any way, just sort of illustrate and let you have a little glimmer of insight into a situation that you might not know. And so the question here is, if somebody in the foster care system is so passionate about what they do that they say, I'm gonna take care of the children, whether it's legal or not. I'm going to help them no matter if I'm breaking the law. So they're doing a good thing that's illegal. And that's the conflict. That's the conflict in several areas throughout The Wrong Girl, is what if somebody's doing something that they think is good? They think it's good, but it's not only illegal, but it may be devastating to families. How do you balance that conflict? How do you make a decision? And what do you do when it happens?
Yeah, lots of moral issues in this one. It just, you know, makes you think completely. What if this were me? What if I didn't really know who my parents were, or wasn't sure who they really were, my real parents, you know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the book, The Wrong Girl, begins with a woman telling the main character, Jane Ryland, a reporter, that she has been reunited with her birth mother, but she thinks she's the wrong girl, putting it that way. I mean, the first line is, "But listen, Jane, I don't think she's my real mother." And Jane begins to suspect that an adoption agency is reuniting birth parents with the wrong children. Now, think about that, because if you were given up for adoption as an infant to an adoption agency, you would have no memory of anything. You know, you wouldn't know who your mother was or who your parents were. The mother may never have seen the child except, you know, for an infinitesimal second. And 20-some years later, you're each looking for each other. What if the agency matched you with the wrong person? How would you know? I mean, if you...
And a lot of authors will tell me that's where they start with, what if...
Yeah,
a what
exactly.
If situation. I mean, what if this and this, and then the story develops from there. And I think I find that fascinating, because it's got to be the easy part, but the hard part is figuring out, you know, who's going to get murdered, what's going to happen in the course of the book. I mean, there's a lot to writing a book.
David, there is no easy part. There is no easy part.
It doesn't come easy. You know? I mean, I have writers who tell me that their characters speak for them. Their characters almost tell them what to write, which is an interesting way of looking at it. I mean, to think that you have to write every word and make every word sound wonderful in every book, you know, that's difficult.
It's very difficult. It's very rewarding. It's incredibly inspirational. It's sometimes inexplicable. I mean, Sue Grafton, who is a dear friend and a mentor, and I talk about this from time to time, how the characters speak through us. And that does happen. I don't want to indicate that that makes it easy, but it does, you know, it's almost like method acting. You know, I sit at the computer, and when I'm writing the Jane Ryland parts of the book, I see the world through her eyes. I take in what she envisions. My imagination is her imagination. My concerns, my take on the world are Jane's. And then when I'm writing the Jake scenes, you know, I change my psyche to be that of a Boston cop. And I see the world how a cop would see it and think about people the way he would think about them. I want what he wants, you know, and that's different from what Jane wants. Sometimes.
I think he wants Jane. That's what I think.
Well, they do. They do. There is that. But, you know, another one of the tensions of the book, of course, is that Jane, as a reporter, wants to cover the crime beat. She's a good, solid crime reporter. If she is known to be dating a source, when she's assigned to a story that Jake is the primary detective on, people are going to suspect that maybe she's not being aggressive enough, that maybe she's not being objective enough, that maybe she's not pushing hard enough, you know, that if something bad happens on this investigation, she's going to let Jake off the hook because, you know, they're together. So she can't do that. She can't be dating a source. Jake, you know, on the other hand, and Jake can't be dating a reporter, a police officer dating a reporter. You know, the first time there's a leak from the department, who's going to be blamed? It's going to be Jake. You know, he can't afford to have it be known that he and Jane have a relationship if they do. So they cannot be together. They love their careers, and they care about their careers, and they're both on their way up in their chosen profession, and they can't be with each other. And yet, on the other hand, they can't not. You know, just as you so wonderfully observed, you know, they're very drawn to each other. So you take two honorable people who, in their professional lives, are as upright and solid and honest as you could possibly imagine, and then put them in a situation personally when they have to lie, you know, when they have to sneak. This is not their personality, and yet, you know, their hearts are telling them this is the right thing to do. So, you know, on every page about, you know, there's this conflict of what are they going to do? Is somebody going to have to quit their job? Are they going to have to give each other up? Neither thing seems like a reasonable answer.
Now, how many books have you written so far? I mean, what number is this?
Well, it depends on what kind of math you do. This is the second of the Jane Ryland books. The first one, as I said, The Other Woman, came out in paperback. But before that, I did another series about a television reporter in Boston. There were four of them in the series, from Mira. Mm-hmm. Very popular, very successful, funny. They're funny, funny mysteries, if you can imagine.
So you have a good sense of humor?
I think, well, that's...
Depends on who I ask, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, ask my husband. I think I'm funny. I think I'm really funny, although sometimes I'll say something that I think is hilarious, and I am met with sort of a blank, baffled stare by whoever I'm talking to. I was on the train the other day to New Jersey, and the conductor took my ticket and punched it into his little handheld computer, and then he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am, you don't exist." And so I burst out laughing, and I said to him, "Well, then I guess I'll go rob a bank." And he said, "Huh?" You know, so...
Yeah, be careful what you say nowadays.
Exactly. So anyway, the four books began with Prime Time, which won the Agatha for Best First Mystery, so I was thrilled about that. Then there was FaceTime, Airtime, and Drive Time, all nominated for the Anthony and Agatha Awards.
Cool.
And they're still on Amazon, that you can still buy the... They came out in... They were paperback originals. You can still buy them on Amazon. You can still... they're all on ebooks on every platform of Kindle and Nook and everything else in the world. And people still buy them. I mean, they're doing just great. So I may return to those books at some point. There are two more, at least, Jane and Jake books.
Are you working on one now?
I should be doing that right now, as a matter of fact. The next one is called Truth Be Told. about a mortgage banker. Jane is on the trail of a mortgage banker who apparently has decided that banks have been bailed out long enough, and it's time for the people to be bailed out. So she manipulates mortgage records to keep people out of foreclosure, to save people's homes.
Well, that sounds interesting.
I hope so. And it's
now,
also
is it
going
to be just like this one where there's a twisty side to it? I mean, and the suspense builds. I hope it's just like this one, because this is such a wonderful book.
Thank you. My style is that Jane has a story that she's working on, and Jake has a murder or two that he's solving. And they seem to be separate, but as the stories progress and the suspense builds, you see how eventually how the stories come together. That's what my editor calls a Hank book. So there's the Jane story and the Jake story, and eventually, you know, the stories come together. And I don't know when I begin how they will come together. So there's always this sort of moment or series of moments when I think, wonder how this is going to work.
It's interesting you pick a quote about curiosity, about Ralph Waldo Emerson in the front of your book, because you must have a huge curiosity.
Well, you know, I do a lot of speeches to, you're so right, I do a lot of speeches to journalism students, and I tell them that there are three main qualities that a good investigative reporter has to have. And the first one is curiosity. There's no question. Curiosity means you care about the world. Curiosity means you wonder if there's more. Curiosity means you like to look beneath the surface, and you want to, and you're drawn to it. I mean, I see everything as a story. When I started out in television, I was the funny one. You know, I was the one who did the cat shows and the features and the On the Road series and those kinds of things. And my news director used to call me Something Out of Nothing Productions, because if they needed a story, they'd say, just send Hank. She'll find something. Because the world is fascinating to me. The world, you know, around every corner is something amazing and new and interesting and wonderful and intriguing. That's how I try to make the books feel, too. So, yeah, curiosity. But, you know, curiosity is the thing that can lead you into danger. You know, someone who wants to know, needs to know, has to know, is compelled to know, is going to eventually ask questions of the wrong people. And that can get them into trouble.
Now, tell me what it was like the first time you saw yourself on TV.
The first time I saw myself on television was in 1975 in Indianapolis. My first television job was in Indianapolis, and I'm telling you, I was terrified. I had never worked in television before. The news director decided that since I had worked at Rolling Stone and had been a writer at Rolling Stone, he could make me into a TV reporter. And that was not that much of a risk for him back then, because I had no contract and my salary was $8,000 a year. I mean, $8,000 a year. And I had no idea what I was doing. And I went home, honestly, for the first 2 weeks of that job, I went home crying, because I just didn't have any idea what they were talking about. You know, there's a lot of jargon, and there's, you know, I had never done a television story. I remember the first story I did, absolutely, was something about the swine flu, something like that, or healthcare, or it might have been a new healthcare law that went into effect. I mean, talk about dry and talk about boring, although I guess that would be the top story right now, too.
Yeah,
interestingly.
Weird how the news stories that were popular then are now popular again today? Yeah. It's just, you never know with society. It changes so much, and yet things become more in the news again and again and again.
Exactly. And I guess the story was just as incomprehensible then as it was now. But I remember, what I remember the most about that story was my little voice, you know, that it was sort of like, and today in Indianapolis, because I was so afraid, you know, I was terrified about the whole concept. It was on film. When I started, all the stories were on film. So I don't have that first story anymore. I wish I did. I wish I had a little if I had a little canister of the film that it was on, I wouldn't be able to watch it anyway, I guess. But, you know, so there's 25-year-old me or however, just being the newest newbie on the planet, which is quite a lovely memory. I mean, I took that job as an inexperienced 25-year-old in Indianapolis, and I really found my calling, as a writer and as a reporter. I mean, it's all about storytelling, whether you're writing for television or whether you're writing crime fiction. That's what it all is telling a good story. I mean, when you say you love The Wrong Girl, that it's a good, suspenseful story, that's what I live for, is, you know, I don't want you to change the channel when you're watching my stories on TV, and I don't want you to be able to put the book down when you're reading my fiction. Right. You know, of course, in TV, you can't make stuff up.
Right. Now, Charles Todd said just wonderful things about you when I was interviewing him. I figured, well, it's time to interview her now after that glowing review. You know, he just loves you. So I thought, now's the perfect time, you know, and I thought, well, he must be right, because they're very good writers, and they don't have time for writers that aren't interesting, so I figured she's got to be interesting.
Well, that's so nice. Charles and Carolyn Todd, who write the Bess Crawford books and the Inspector Rutledge books, I mean, are they not the most elegant, caring, thoughtful, educated, and the stories are so brilliant. I have a mad crush on Inspector Rutledge. I mean, I know that that's just doomed. But,
but see, that's one of the problems. He is doomed, and yet...
Yeah. I mean, we talked about that, you know, that he has Hamish in his head, and if he gets well, the books go away.
Exactly. He really can't fall in love either, which is another crying shame, you know, because the man is, you know, he knows that if he falls in love, whoever he falls in love with is going to have to experience what he's experiencing with this other person. You know, she may think he's crazy.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's what makes the book so beautiful and textured, and that's what makes them be able to be so successful, is that people really care about someone who's doomed. I mean, that's an interesting concept.
Now, you got to interview a lot of famous rock stars. You know things about rock stars that we would love to hear, but you can't really talk about it, I'm sure. But, that must have been a great time, and the 70s was such a great time for rock.
Well, yes, but let me just say that I worked for Rolling Stone's Politics magazine. There was a new section of the magazine that Jan Wenner, the editor-in-chief, had started called Politics, that Richard Goodwin, who had been a speechwriter and assistant to President Kennedy, was the editor of this section of the magazine called Politics. And I worked for the Politics section. So our offices were in Washington, D.C., and I edited a column called Capital Chatter, which was sort of the inside scoop on what was happening in Washington. So, you know, the Watergate hearings and the CIA hearings and everything that was going on in the Capitol at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing, you know, and so when the music people would come through, certainly, and when they were on the cover, I did my radio show, as I said, and interviewed them. But I didn't cover rock and roll so much, although I was deeply embedded into music at that time. When I was in high school, one of the things I wanted to be was a disc jockey.
What a thrill it would be. I think of some of my favorite songs. I think, what if I could interview that person who wrote that song? I mean, it's such... There's some beautiful, beautiful music out there, and to be able to ask somebody where it comes from, what the origin of the song is, it's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, there was a wonderful interview with Paul Simon, my idol, on 60 Minutes years ago, and it was just the most inspirational and fascinating look into a genius's mind. You know, you think about somebody, I mean, we talk about writers. I mean, there's a writer, there's a poet. It's just a different kind of writing but his songs are stories, you know, fictional stories with suspense and emotion. Fabulous.
Absolutely. And he married Carrie Fisher at one point, which is, you know, just blows your mind, you know.
Yeah, the world is interesting. You got to admit, the world is interesting.
There's just, and that makes it easier for you to write. There's so many interesting things to write about. I mean, one thing after another. Now, you say there's going to be at least four in this series. Well, why do you limit it to four, or is that just...
Oh, I don't. I don't limit it to four. You know, it just depends on you. It depends on the readers. There are four that are under contract right now.
Oh, okay.
So I'm
But you'd like to write, would you like to write 20 of them?
Absolutely so. There are endless possibilities of wonderful stories. You pick a topic that people care about in The Other Woman, which is sort of the good wife meets Law and Order. Is about a reporter on the trail of an ex-governor's secret mistress in the midst of a Senate campaign. Is there another woman in the... Does one of the candidates have a mistress? Is there another woman? Who is the other woman? And why would someone be the other woman? And that book came from an article I read about Mark Sanford, who the ex-governor of South Carolina, who told his wife and staff and family that he was out hiking the Appalachian Trail when he was really out with his mistress.
Is that right?
And I mean, it's such an incredible story. And at the end of this article, someone was quoted as saying, "You can choose your sin, but you cannot choose your consequences." And I just thought, my book, that's my book. I can write a book about that. Who would be the other woman? And why? And, you know, is it lust? Is it love? Is it power? Is it sex? Is it deception? Is it manipulation? Is it selfishness? Is it greed? You know, what would be a reason that no one had ever written about that someone would be the other woman and that could lead to murder and scandal? And it was just amazing. It was just amazing to write. And The Wrong Girl came from a phone call I got at Channel 7 from someone who said, you know, she had been, her cousin had been looking for her birth parent for 20 years. The adoption agency had called them, and she had been reunited with her birth mother, and it was the wrong woman. And she said, "Can you believe it? They sent that woman the wrong girl." I mean, again, I got goosebumps. And I thought, oh, my goodness, my book. You know, this is it. This is what I have to write. So it's an important, interesting, fascinating problem that we all care about. You know, we all care about our relationships with our parents. We all care about our husbands and wives and what fidelity means. And, you know, we all care about, in truth be told, we all care about our homes. How far would we go to protect our home? What would you do?
And look at today with all the tweeting and texting and things that are going on. I mean, everything you do now is... You know, husbands and wives are like, who are they tweeting? Who are they talking to? You know, there's so many more possibilities to talk to other people today. It's like, wow, you know, and everybody's so suspicious. You know, you see your husband tweeting. Who are you tweeting with, you know?
Well, you know, there's so many possibilities, and from the standpoint of being a mystery author, though, a crime fiction author, that can kind of make a problem, because it used to be that a detective or an amateur detective or a police officer only had so many ways of contacting someone or finding out about something or doing research. Now everything is absolutely presented. You know, there used to be obstacles in the way of investigation, and now there are fewer and fewer. You know, you can only have somebody have a dead battery on their telephone once. You know, and right. Then after that, it's too coincidental.
It's got to sound, your book is very authentic. I mean, you read it and you just, everything feels real, which is what I like about it. I mean, it's not like the stories where you're just like, oh, not this kind of a story again. Like, I've seen this all before, you know?
Thank you. I hope so. You know, on the audio book of The Other Woman, Lee Child interviews me. And we talk about this very thing. Yeah, he did a great interview with me. I mean, how generous and wonderful.
I can't get an interview with that man. That really bugs me to death. I don't know what it is.
You just be patient. You know, I think he's in England a lot of the year, and he also has a house in France, and he sells a book every second. You know, they sell a book every second.
Interesting. I mean, he is. He's a fascinating man, but you can't pin him down to do an interview. But anyway.
Well, he's charming and very, very generous and has a tremendous number of fans. And he and I were talking in this interview about the verisimilitude, I mean, the reality of writing, and how one of the things that's exciting about writing novels, and one of the things that makes it, remember, he used to work in television too in England, and it's about, we don't know when we're covering a news story, we don't know what's going to happen next. We are out there doing the investigation, doing the reporting, doing the work, but we don't know what the answer will be. And that's just exactly how it is for me to write a mystery thriller. I don't know what the end will be, but it's not scary or intimidating too much, because it's just what I've been doing every day for 40 years, going after the story, seeing what happens at the end.
Now, do you always have that opening line? I mean, you talk about the opening line of what Tuck says to Jane. I mean, is that a trademark with you, where you have a really interesting opening line with every book?
I can't write it. I can't write the book unless I know the opening line. I just can't. I can't start.
Well, can you tell us the opening line to the next book?
Of Truth Be Told?
Yeah,
sure. The opening line of Truth Be Told is, I know it's Jane talking. And she says, I know it's legal, but it's terrible.
Oh. See, the opening lines are fascinating.
Aren't they? Absolutely so. My favorite line, I think, I don't know what my favorite one is, but the one that I burst out laughing still thinking about is the opening line of my book, Airtime, which is, it's never a good thing when the flight attendant is crying.
Exactly.
I mean, but think about that. I mean, I don't want to overanalyze it, but it's never a good thing when the flight attendant is crying. You know you're on an airplane. You know that the person has, whoever the narrator is, has been on an airplane before, because it's never a good thing means she has some experience. You know a flight attendant is crying, so something instantly is wrong. And there are all kinds of things that you know just from that opening line. I know it's legal, but it's terrible, the opening line of Truth Be Told. You know, the reader has to instantly hold in their brain that what could be terrible that's legal? The law.
I need to read the rest of this and find out what it is.
You know, but listen, Jane, I don't think she's my real mother. Introduces that she has a person who's going to tell her something. Introduces, like, that there's a conflict instantly. I don't think she's my real mother. Really? You know, what does that mean? What is real mother? And why would someone be saying that? And something bad has clearly happened in the first line. And they say that, you know, every line you write ought to lead inexorably to the next one, force the reader to read the next one.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do.
Well, it's not easy. And the more I read, the more I realize, boy, this is difficult stuff. It's not like you just sit down and write a book and it's done. I mean, there's so much involved. I mean, you do a lot of rewrites, I'm sure, like any author. And, you know, it's just a lot of work. A lot of, you know, you can't repeat yourself from book to book. You can't say, well, I remember that part from another book. Everything's got to be fresh and new. It's like a TV show. Every episode's got to be a new show.
Everything has got to be absolutely new from people's decisions.
Even the phrasing of it.
Absolutely so. I mean, writers have styles. I mean, you recognize the Charles Todd book, you recognize the Hank Phillippe Ryan book, you recognize a Lee Child book, you recognize that feel. So you don't want to think, wow, where did this come from? This isn't how, I mean, you know what a Sue Grafton book is going to be when you pick it up. You know, it's comfortable, but we work very hard to make them be the best they can possibly be of our style, the best and freshest and most unique and the most surprising in a way that still fits with who we are and what our style is.
You must have a very exciting life in a lot of ways. You sound like you have a lot of fun. I mean, 40 years in the same, and now you're writing, you're doing like everything that's really interesting. And that must be really, you must wake up in the morning and think, well, I have an interesting life.
I wake up in the morning and I think, where am I, is basically what I think. No, and I don't, you're so right. I count my blessings every moment of every day. I am, you know, I'm very, very lucky. I'm very, very tired. I work incredibly hard. I've been a workaholic ever since I can remember. But it's thrilling. I enjoy it. When someone says, I love your books, you know, I'm getting a lot of reaction to The Wrong Girl from people who are adopted or from people who were foster children or who have foster children. A lot of reaction from people who are looking for their birth parents. You know, that this is something that really speaks to them. This book is about them, and their search and about their disappointments and about their fears and about what happens to someone who is searching for their birth parent, you know, that need to find out our history. You know, I used to taunt my mother when I was little, saying, you know, when my real mother comes, she won't make me make my bed. I mean, how many of us use that that idea? You know, this is so much our core, who we are, and that's what this book is about. So when someone says to me, "This is just what it was like for me looking for my birth parent," or "This is just what it was like for me as a foster child," or "This is just what it was like for me looking for my daughter," I think, okay, you know, I did it. I connected with someone who needed it, and that's great. Plus, you know, they're murder mysteries. We like when the bad guys get what's coming to them, and we like when justice happens. And that's my goal also in these books. I picture someone reading The Wrong Girl on an airplane and being sorry when they arrive at their destination because they wish they could just read one more chapter.
Right, and I like the fact your next book doesn't have girl or woman in the title. It's different. It's Truth Be Told, so it's a different kind of a title. I was beginning to think you were going to put girl or woman or lady in every book, every one of your books, and I thought it's interesting that you picked a different title for the next one.
Good. I'm glad you like Truth Be Told. We love it, and we're very excited about it. And that'll be out in September of 2014, which is going to come faster than we know.
September 4th, yeah, that's right around the corner, it seems like. It's October here in Pennsylvania, but I'm looking outside now, and the sun is shining, and it's a little hot outside today, which is weird for October, but, you know. This book takes place in the wintertime, which is interesting, because I'm reading, I'm thinking, oh, God, I remember some of these winters. You know, and of course, your Massachusetts winters are worse than Pennsylvania's a lot of times.
Well, the winter in The Wrong Girl is certainly a character in the book. There's no question about it that the snow and sleet and rain and tough weather and conditions affect what everyone does. You know, it's a lot different hurrying to a crime scene when it's pouring down snow than it is when it's sunny outside.
Now, did you write that book when it was snowing?
No, and that's the funny part. You know, it's November in the book, but I was writing it, in August. So, you know, I was writing it during the summer, and so I had a little yellow sticky on my computer that said it's cold.
Just so you remember.
It
sounds silly, but there's little things you have to be careful of.
No, exactly. It was really funny because in the winter, people need coats. They need to put on a coat to go outside. They need boots. It's slushy. It's wet. You can't see the sidewalk. When they come into a place, their glasses are going to fog up. You need to take off your coat. You need to put it somewhere. You know, it's going to be wet and drippy. You know, there are all kinds of things, all kinds of realities that you need to take into account when, you know, for the weather. And truth be told, it's May in Boston, but it's in a heat wave. You know, so people are hot and people are sticky and people are plugging in their air conditioners and people have the windows open. And so when the windows are open, you can hear what's happening outside. When an air conditioner is running, you can't hear what's happening outside. So all those kinds of things. That's why setting is such a part of the book and such a part of character, because everything that happens in your setting affects what happens to the characters.
Exactly. Now, you are a member on the board of MWA, Mystery Writers of America. What exactly does that entail for you?
Well, the main thing that being on MWA board entails is that I'm on the faculty of MWA University, which is a group of authors who travel around the country giving mystery writing classes.
Any authors we would have heard of? I mean, names.
Reed Farrell Coleman, Dan Stashower, Harley Jane Kozak, Charlene Harris, Jess Lowry, Hallie Efron, did I say her?
Wow.
You know, so we've had Nancy Picard. It's been just a wonderful experience, and it's open to the public. The next one coming up is in San Diego, October the 12th in San Diego.
That's so around the corner.
Go
yeah.
to MWA website and get the info. It's open to the public. And then
now, are you ever a reader for like the Edgar Awards or any of those awards?
Oh, yes. I've been a judge for the Edgars and the International Thriller Writers. Yeah, it's fascinating. It's a huge job. I mean, I judged the Edgars 1 year, last year, 2 years ago, one of those. And, you know, huge boxes of books arrive at your on my porch, and I'm saying to the UPS, he's saying, "Ma'am," the UPS guy goes, "Ma'am, you know, here's another box for you from HarperCollins."
And they start to wonder what is in these.
I don't buy these. You know, these are contest entries. So it's a fabulous education to be a judge of one of those awards. You know, you get to read every book, and
how do you make the time to read so much?
You know, you just do what you have to do. I mean, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but you just do what you have to do. My theory of judging is that I treat every book as if I treat every book the same way I'd want someone to treat my book if my book were entered in a contest. And, you know, that works.
And the joy and the excitement of really reading a good book is amazing. You can't wait to talk about it.
There's nothing like that. And when someone likes your book, as you said, you liked The Wrong Girl so much, and I'm
really
so pleased with that. The best thing you can possibly do is tell people about it. That is, I mean, no pressure, just my career is at stake here. That's what makes a difference, is word of mouth. A friend telling a friend telling a friend that they love The Wrong Girl is the best thing that could possibly happen. You know, people say, how do you succeed in this business? And I say, it's because friends tell friends that they loved my books. I rely on it, and I am grateful every time it happens.
Exactly, and that's all you. It's amazing with books, how you can connect with a book. I mean, one book you'll pick up, and you're like, I don't know about this. And then the next book you pick up, you just instantly get into it, and that feeling of, wow, this is something great. I wish I could feel that every book I read, you know. And you know, it's difficult because you don't feel that way with every book.
Nope, it's wonderful when you find a good one. There's no question about that. And it's a treasure. I mean, there's some kind of alchemy that happens between the... I mean, I always think that the book is not fulfilled until someone reads it. So I write the book, I put it out there, and I wait to see who my other half is. You know, I wait to see who is the person who's going to get it, who's the person who's going to really understand and connect with that book. And when it happens, it's wonderful.
I read a book recently. I can't even get it out of my head. It's been a month or two since I read it. It's called Kind of Cruel by Sophie Hanna. I'm never going to be able to forget this book. I don't know why. It's one of those books that stays with you a long time after you read it. And, you know, it's an amazing experience. I mean, and you don't feel that way with every book, but that one hit me hard. That one was like, wow, I can't wait to read more by this author, you know. And
she's great. I'm sure she's out there applauding right now. There's nothing better that you could have said.
And Gone Girl is another one. Gone Girl, I mean, I'll never forget that book, ever. I mean, that, to me, that was a masterpiece.
Yep, so many people think so, and that has been such a juggernaut. And again, we were talking about structure. You know, the structure of Gone Girl is unique and fresh and fabulous and fascinating, and the concept and the presentation.
You're riveted. You're absolutely riveted to that book. Even though people have been controversial about the endings and, you know, who cares? It's a wonderful read. I mean, you may not like the ending necessarily or think it should have been different, but, you know, that's the writer's style, and you can't take that away from the writer.
Yeah, I love the ending.
But, you know, and the endings are so important. I'm sure they are with your books. I mean, it has to be a good ending. It has to make sense. It can't just be thrown together like you pull a character that nobody's ever heard of and make them the murderer. It's like, you can't do that.
Exactly, and that's what I should be working on right now.
But it's all
the ending of Truth Be Told.
And if it turns out to be somebody you've seen in a book and didn't realize was a bad guy, it's somehow very satisfying.
You have to be fair, and you have to be honest, and it has to make sense, but it still has to be a surprise, and that is a very interesting juggle.
Right. Well, we've just about run out of time. Boy, I can't believe it's 4 minutes, and it's like 2 minutes. I mean, it's been so wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you. How nice of you. For me, too. It's a treat to talk about The Wrong Girl. It's a treat to talk about The Other Woman. It's a treat to think about people out there hearing this and thinking, I'm going to go get The Wrong Girl right now. And that is
I think
such
I want
a
to
joy.
Read Truth
Thank
Be,
you.
I want to read Truth Be Told. I'm dying to read it now. I wish you could slip me a copy in the mail.
You know, if I could slip you a copy in the mail, I would. That would mean it was done.
Oh, it's not even done yet.
It'll be done very soon. Really soon.
Not soon enough for
me.
Not soon enough for me, that's for sure.
Sweetheart, not soon enough for me either, let me just put it that way.
Oh, really? It's got to be, you know, you want to get it done. It must be a great feeling when a book is done for you. when it's totally
it's
done.
It's completely the best. It's the best. You just are, you know, it's so difficult to write a book, and it's, the other day in writing, the other day in writing, truth be told, I really figured out something. I figured out a very difficult situation, and there I am by myself in my study, and I stood up and applauded, and then I thought, oh my goodness, I'm glad nobody's here to see me.
They were going to be there with the white coats and take me
exactly.
away because I'm crazy.
Exactly.
But anyway, the book again is called The Wrong Girl, Hank Philippi Ryan, and it's out from Forge. And so, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you. If your listeners have experiences about being foster children or looking for their birth parents or searching for their children, their birth children, come to my website, HankPhilippiRyan.com. Click on contact. That comes right to me. Or find me at Hank Philippi Ryan author page on Facebook. I love to talk to readers. Well, I talk about my life and talk about personal stuff and talk about book things. We have a lot of fun on Hank Philippi Ryan author page on Facebook, so I hope you'll join me there. And I hope you look for The Wrong Girl.
Yeah,
as I said, no pressure. It's just my career.
Wonderful. And this has been David's Book Talking. We'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.